We are on Ayin Vav Med Aleph, 76a. We are about 8-9 lines up from the bottom at Rav Papa. The Gemara had been talking about the degree of kashering that is necessary for a roasting spit. And we had posed a problem. Our Mishnah said, you do libun. You heat it up until it's white hot, and we're going to talk about exactly what that means in the Gemara today. And the that was our Mishnah's approach. But there's a Gemara in Zvachim which is talking about karbanos, and specifically the concern that if a karban is absorbed in the vessel that was used for cooking the karban, then whatever absorption is in it becomes nosar, becomes leftovers once the period of time for consumption of the karban elapses. And in the event that you cook something else in there now, at that point your vessel becomes whatever you cook in there becomes nosar as well, because becomes treif. You're not allowed to eat it. So we said that in order to kasher a spit that had been used for cooking a karban, you require hagalah. Hagalah, boiling up water in it, is not the same thing as libun, making something white hot. So our challenge in the Gemara, that's really been the length of the page here, has been how to understand the fact that regarding a karban, you only need hagalah, but regarding treif, you need libun. So our first answer, if you're looking at the source sheet, and I'll actually share the screen with the source sheet. That's odd. It's not offering me the sharing option for reasons that are unclear. I don't know, my computer is doing funny things, so it's not letting me share it right now. So, I wonder why that is. Computers. Okay, so in any case, those who have the source sheet with them will... Oh, you know what? Hang on. No. No, it's not allowing me to share it. I don't know why. Okay. In any case, we had a table on the source sheet. It's still there. I can hold it up like this, and that will be my sharing of my screen. But that's not really going to do much. So Rav Sheshes gave us the first answer, and Rav Sheshes says we're more lenient when it comes to a karban, because when the spit absorbed from the karban, it absorbed permitted material, hetera bala. And we noted Ramban's explanation that when something absorbs permissible material, then we can be more lenient. It would require a larger quantity of material in order for it to communicate non-kosher status. We went through the whole thing from Ramban, then I'm not going to go through it again now. But we're more lenient with what we call hetera bala. That was Rishesh's answer. Rabbah did not like that answer, because Rabbah said it's all well and good that it absorbed permitted material, but the material became noser, became leftovers. So now it's prohibited material. It's not permitted material anymore. So Rabbi gave me a different answer. He said, no, you misunderstood the Gemara in Zvachim. The Gemara in Zvachim was not talking about how you kosher things at all. The Gemara in Zvachim was talking about after you kosher it, you also have to rinse the thing out. Umorak v'shutach b'mayim, you have to rinse out the vessel, and that's what Hagala referred to. Hagala was not a reference to how you kosher it. You kosher it with libun, just like in our Gemara. That was Rabbah's answer, to which Abaye said, that doesn't fit. Hagala is hot. Rinsing, what the Torah calls umorak v'shutach b'mayim, is cold water. So when it says Hagala, it can't be referring to the rinsing. That doesn't make any sense. And Abaye said, I'll tell you what. The answer, according to Abaye, is that both in our case of treif and in Zvachim, dealing with karbanos, we actually require two steps to the process, libun and Hagala. It's not enough to have one. You actually need to have both. That was Abaye's answer. Even though here it only said libun, and there it only said hagala, you actually need to do both. That was Abaye's answer. To which Rava, student of Abaye, says, if that were true, then the Gemara should have said so. If it were true that you needed both, you shouldn't have told me you need one step here and give me the other step in Zvachim without ever indicating to me that the two go together, that both steps are required. That didn't make any sense. So Rava does not like that idea at all. And Rava gives me an entirely different approach. He says we're lenient in the Karban case because there's never any actual treif there. Nothing became nosar. Nothing became leftovers because the way that they cooked up the karbanos, they ensured that at the end of every day, they would cook a shlamim in this receptacle, and therefore you would extend the time frame for the materials, and now it would not become nosar, it would not become leftovers, which was a nice answer. The only problem with the answer, which we noted at the end last time, is then why are you doing Haggalah at all? If everything is kosher, then why are you koshering it? That didn't seem to make any sense. And the Gemara didn't deign to respond. The Gemara says, yeah, kosher, that's a problem. We can deal with that. Sorry, there was a question?
Well, just more than that, according to that shita, then we never have nursery. I mean, we didn't have nursery ever.
Except if you didn't do it well, right?
Okay, but it seems like the assumption here is that we're doing it properly, and therefore we'll never have a din of nursery, and we know we have a din of nursery.
Right, but no, I mean, the answer would be, what if you didn't do this? I mean, but it's such a strange thing. Like, that answer is a strange answer. So what we're up to is Rav Papa. And again, Rav Papa is about 10 lines up from the bottom. Unfortunately, I'm having some kind of weird screen sharing problem, and I don't know why. Now, I'm going to try one thing here and see if this helps. Let me see if that... No. I don't know why, but suddenly my screen sharing option is not working, and I don't get why. So I'm not going to be able to share my Gemara with you, but hopefully you'll be able to look on in your own, and those who don't have their own will be able to listen. Rav Papa Omar, Avitara Shabbe Alpe. Rav Papa Omar, hi Karid, hi Lo Karid. Rav Papa's answer is that the difference between the Yerushalmi version, the Zvachim version, and our version is that in our version, we're talking about a vessel with treif. You're talking about the stuff that you got out of Midyan. So the stuff that you got out of Midyan, those vessels that you got out of Midyan, aren't used on a daily basis. And because they're not used on a daily basis, so the material toughens and hardens in it, and greater koshering is going to be required. Whereas the vessels in the Beis HaMikdash that are used for cooking the karbanos are used on a daily basis. And therefore, it's a lot easier to get the stuff out because it never really toughens. There's no crust that develops of this material in the vessels. I could have made an argument the opposite direction, right? You could have said in the Beis HaMikdash we have a principle ein anius b'makom ashiros, that you're not supposed to have poverty in a place of wealth. You're always supposed to make sure the Beis HaMikdash is very well outfitted. And following along those lines, I could have made the argument that the Beis HaMikdash should have so many sets of utensils that they don't, in fact, need to use them all the time. Today, use this one. Tomorrow, use that one. The next day, use a third one. And the vessels of the non-Jews that you got in war, on the other hand, we could have made the argument that those are used all the time. But he doesn't. We do say stam kelim lav bnei yoman. We assume that the vessels were not used that day for the non-Jews, and therefore the treif hardened within it. Whereas the Beis HaMikdash vessels are used regularly, and therefore you only need to do Haggalah. That's your Papa's answer. Yes, Jack.
Is that true that certain types of pottery they use in Beis HaMikdash, that they could only use them once because of the nosar?
So if you look in the Psukim, I referenced them last week. I didn't bring them again on the sheet this week. They talk about how if you cooked your karban in pottery, then you have to smash it. You can't use it again. Pottery is not kosherable. That's what you're thinking of. That wasn't actually in the Beis HaMikdash. That wasn't the Beis HaMikdash thing. The Beis HaMikdash's vessels were silver and gold. But it was when, if you cooked your karban in it, then you would you would have to smash it. That's correct. Okay. So, but that was Rav Papa's answer. Rav Ashi goes back to our first answer to conclude the discussion. And Rav Ashi goes back to the idea that it's different when you're kashering from carbon use because permitted material was absorbed. Now, we challenged that and said, yeah, but by the time you get around to kashering it, it's treif material. It's no longer permitted material. So look what he says. Rav Ashi Omar, Rav Ashi's answer is, La'olam kida amran me'ikara. It's what we said in the first place, that the carbon case, permitted material was absorbed. Hacha hetera bala, hacha isura bala. Here it absorbed prohibited material, here is our permitted material. And as far as Rabba's challenge of, but when you're actually doing the kashering, it's prohibited material that's emerging. He says that's true, but at the time that you're removing the treif that's absorbed, it's nothing you can see. All it is I boil up water in the thing, or it's a spit, so I insert the spit in the boiling water. You can't see carbon coming out of the spit. It's not even visible. So therefore he says, I'm not worried about that. As long as the visible stuff from which it absorbed in the first place was permitted material, I don't care about what it's going to look like at the time that it emerges. It's not recognizable. It's not visible. So I go with the rules from the time of the absorption. That's what he says. I have to admit, I have a hard time squaring the logic here with Ramban. I haven't seen anybody who sought to demonstrate how Rav Ashi can work with Ramban's theory of hetera bala, which we discussed 2 weeks ago. But he simply says it as a fiat. This is simply so, and he concludes the discussion. The Gemara has now lost interest in this conversation about the two spits, and it moves on. No one's going to challenge Rav Ashi on this point, but instead they look at the big shiny issue of Libun and the question of what exactly Libun is. So, any questions on the tale of two spits, or do we go on with the Libun? Okay, then we go on with Libun. So,
what was Rav Ashi saying?
Rav Ashi goes back to the idea that we first suggested in this sugya, the very first answer that we offered from Rav Sheshes, to say that the material that was absorbed in the spit was absorbed when it was permitted, and therefore the kashering process can be more lenient.
With
Hagala.
Okay.
That was Hagala. And the and even though Rabba had pointed out that, yeah, but at the time that you do the kashering, it's actually treif, he says that doesn't matter because it's not visible at this point. It's lost its significance. Okay. So four lines up from the bottom. Ve'ad kama melabnon. How far do you have to go in order to do libun? That's our question. Meaning, when you say it has to get white hot, what does that look like? So Amar Rabbi Mani ad shetashir klipasan. He says until it sheds the outer layer. Whatever the outer layer means is not clear to me. I saw one source that suggested it means the treif that has actually accrued to it, whatever was on the outside. So you now have exposed the core metal of the spit. Maybe that's the explanation. But it's when the outer layer sloughs off, that's what we call libun. However, the Shulchan Aruch gives you a different idea, based on the Rush, which is really from the Yerushalmi. So I brought it on your sheet. For those who are using the source sheet, the Yerushalmi says, "V'halibun tzarech shiyahu nitzotzos minat zin mimena." Libun is to the point where sparks emerge from it. When the material has sparks emerging, that is when you have achieved libun. It is that hot. So we generally use the term white hot, libun lavan, right? That's the meaning white. That's the term that we throw on it. But the idea is that it's hot enough that it's sparking, like it can generate fire in its own right. That's libun. And then the Gemara moves on. Like, the Gemara says, okay, that's interesting. I would have expected a lot more detail on what Liban looks like. Because... So we do have a discussion about Libun Kal and Libun Chamor, or Libun Gamor, in Halacha, but it's not the Gemara's distinction. That's when we... Yeah, no, that's a distinction that we throw on it, which relates to when do we really need Libun and when do we not really need Libun. But but it's just, it's very odd to me that no one here in this Gemara is curious about, you know, what exactly this looks like, unless the answer is that the Gemara doesn't need to be curious because this is something people are doing all the time, and therefore it's sort of like, yeah, we all know what that is, we do it. So, you know, we don't really need to unpack that. You know, that could be the answer. It's just not. Everybody knows what that is. So that could be why. Okay, but the Gemara is more interested in Hag'ala and a specific problem of Hag'ala. Hag'ala, we've said, is you boil the thing up. You put it in water at a high boil. So the Gemara asks V'ketzad mag ilan, three lines up from the bottom. Amar Rav Huna, yora ketana, besoch yora gedola. If you have a small pot that needs hagala, you stick it in a big pot, immersed in water, you heat it to the point where the water is at a rolling boil, and you're done. Now the truth is, what I just said is not the way we do it. I should be more careful. What we do is we bring the water to the rolling boil first, and then we immerse the pot. It's a longer discussion as to why, but that's actually the way it's supposed to be done. Not heating it with the pot in it. But that's what he says you're supposed to do, is you immerse it in a bigger pot. So that leads to the inevitable question. What do you do with your largest sized pot? Now what am I supposed to do? The Yorah Gedolamai, what do you do with your large pot? So the Gemara tells you a story about how one of the sages solved the problem. I think I brought you on the sheet. Yeah, it's source Gimel. If you skip source Beis and you go to source Gimel, which is at the top of the second side, the Vilna Gaon notes, Kli Rishon Lo Sagi Bi'iroi. If you're koshering something that had actually been on the stove itself, then you're not able to just pour hot water on it. In other words, I might have thought, okay, so if I can't immerse it, pour boiling water on it. That's called iroi. That does not work. She'enu mavliya umaflit rak kedei klipa. And the reason is because the Gemara in Pesachim says if you pour hot water on something, it will draw stuff out of only the most external thin layer, and that's it. And therefore, he says, it's not going to be good enough. We need a different method. So what's the method that we do need? So we turn to the story in our Gemara. We are on the next to last line, end of the next to last line. Ta Shema, come in here. Dehahu duda dahavoy be rav akavya, or ukva, depending on your edition. We've got both names associated with the story. But there was a dud is a pot, right? If you think of in Israel, a dud shemesh, right? Where they heat up the water using solar panels. So the kettle that holds the water is called a dud. So they had a pot in the house of Rav Akavya or Rav Ukva, and they needed to kasher it. So what did he do? So what he did was, and see, those who never thought they would actually see Ayin Vav Amud Beis, here it is. We see Ayin Vav Amud Beis. Someone has to tell Brian that we made it to Ayin Vav Amud Beis. They gave it a lip of dough all around the pot, and then filled up the pot with water, and boiled it up. So, what's the advantage of the lip? For just physically, what has the lip accomplished? Yes. Sorry? Clive, you're going to say?
Well, when the water expands with the heat, it will overflow the whole pot.
Yeah. Well, that was going to do with, it was going to do that with or without the lip. What's the advantage of the lip? Now you keep your fire going, right?
Yeah.
In other words, in the event that I simply... Oh, wait, Thomas has his hand up. Okay, yes, Thomas.
So you can fill up the pot completely.
Right. Right. You can fill up the pot completely with water and let it overflow. It's not going to put out the fire now, because it'll be held back by the lip. That's what you're accomplishing. We'll see a little bit more in the Ritva, who's going to clarify what the benefit is of this method shortly. But the idea now is you can actually have an overflow. The Chavrusa on this Gemara, those who have a Chavrusa Gemara, has another explanation, but it doesn't fit what I think what the Gemara says or what the Rishonim say. So I don't know where he got his idea from. This is what I think is going on.
Which way did the lip go upwards? Maybe the pods are higher or sideways?
So the lip is actually running sideways from under the edge of the pot. So that it juts out, and it's a receptacle, essentially. That's what I'm envisioning here. So so it's going to catch the water. What's the milo? What's the advantage of doing that? So here I refer you to source base on your sheet. And the Ritva, before source base, go run a couple lines further in the Gemara, because otherwise the Ritva is not going to make any sense. So Amar Rava. Okay, if you see the second line in Ayin Vav Amud Beis, Amar Rava, Rava says, Man chakim lemeavad kiha milsa ilav rabakavya or ukva degavra rabahu. He says, this man is just brilliant. Who would have been as brilliant as Rabakavya to come up with this idea of the lip? Wow, was that a good idea. Kasavar kibolo kachpolto. What's going on? Because he believed that the way that the pot absorbs is the way that will also spit out whatever it absorbed. Mabolo benitzotzos, apolto benitzotzos. Just like it absorbed the hot water via the sparks, meaning the droplets of water that pop out of the pot when you boil up the pot, so too, through the water overflowing the edge, it will now get rid of the absorption. So he's really, really impressed, Rava is, with this strategy. What was it that so impressed Rava about this? What's the beauty of this? So we'll see Rashi and we'll see the Ritva. Both of them are in source base on your sheet. Mabolo benitzotzos apolto benitzotzos. So Pirish Rashi. Rashi says, and he quotes you Rashi, and then he explains Rashi. I skipped the actual words of Rashi so I could see his explanation. V'nira milishono zal. It appears that what Rashi is saying here is dechochmasei demar okva haynu b'may deshayre b'li hachnasa b'yora acheres. What was brilliant here was that he found a way to permit this pot to do the kashering without having to sink it into another pot that you don't have. The challenge was, what do I do to kosher it? I can't submerge it in a larger pot. He found a way to kosher it. In other words, it's a mechanical thing that he figured out. It was a mechanical strategy that others it didn't dawn on them how they could possibly make this work, and he came up with a way to make it work. Essentially, what he did was he created a bigger pot. Right, by giving it the lip, he created a bigger pot. So it's a mechanical strategy. However, the Ritva says that's not the limit of the brilliance here. V'hanachon, he says, you know what I think is correct. Dekula chokmasei hainu begedanfa. He says the brilliance is the lip. Because what happened was this. When this pot was treif, it absorbed from what was inside it. We're not in a carbon case, remember. This is the non-Jew's pot. So the non-Jew's pot absorbed every time he cooked treif in it. Time after time, the lip of the pot, the original lip of the pot, absorbs from whatever drops sprayed out of the pot. And he says, Pa'amim kan, upa'amim kan. sometimes the drops would spark over here, and sometimes they're over there, right? When you boil up water in a pot, you know what happens. Drops spray out. Sometimes they'll spray here, sometimes they'll spray there. And he says, the point is, Ach nispashtu nitzotzos b'chol ha-safa v'nivla akula, to the point where the drops extend all the way around the rim, and the whole rim has now absorbed. So what? He says the problem is, and what Mar Ukva or Rav Ukva or Rav Akavia is dealing with is the problem. V'ilu b'hagala pamachas v'lo afilu b'shtayim lo hayu ola nitzotas b'kula. He says, let's say you didn't do the lip. You just filled the pot to the top. You boiled it up. And now drops are sparking out of the pot. They're spraying here and there. And you say, I kashered the pot. That won't work. Because this thing was used to cook treif 100 times. And the drops that came out of it got all over the edge of the pot. When you do your hagala once, even if you do your hagala twice, you're not getting the entire lip wet with the drops that spray out of the pot. It's not going to work. The point of the lip is that now the entire edge is going to be exposed to hot water. Even though the water won't stay on that spot, it'll be enough to kasher whatever absorption of treif came about when the drops hit the edge. You follow?
When the water is splashing everywhere,
yeah.
Does it splash on the sides of the keli also, not just on the lip?
Not really. So, I mean, just...
Is that the internal part of the keli or not?
So I think from a physics perspective, you're not getting any real amount that's going to land on the side. Unless you're talking about where it actually boils over. If... Sorry?
It's happened many times.
Right, no. If it boiled over and washed down the side, then I think you'd be right. They don't seem to be concerned for that. I suspect that knowing how careful they were with water back in the day when getting water meant going to the river or pumping it out of something, I don't know what, they weren't filling the pot to the top in a normal circumstance. That would be my guess. Because you're right. You're right. I mean, if I fill it to the top, of course it's going to wash down the side, and now I've got real absorption that should be happening. But they don't seem to be expecting that to have happened. So what the Ritva is suggesting here is, Rashi thinks that the brilliance of this is that now I don't need to submerge the thing in a larger pot. Because I have this lip. But he says, no, the point isn't that you created a big pot by doing this. The point is that now you're able to kosher the effect of 100 boilings and splashings and sprayings with a single hagala, because the water will go over the edge, and here they will, Maury, go over the edge and get caught by that lip. That seems to be the way that the Ritva reads this. In practice, what do we do when we have to kosher a very large pot? So I brought you on the sheet, and again, I don't know why I'm being blocked on sharing the screen properly, but I am. Now is it letting me? What can you see now?
See the paper says that you're pinched out there. Just yeah.
What are you seeing? Then? You're seeing the Bar Ilan?
Yeah.
Okay, so if I do this, are you seeing the source sheet?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's doing a very odd kind of share, but I'll go with it because it's working. That's not the way sharing is supposed to work. You're supposed to have to actually choose which screen you want to share. But as long as it's working, I'm cool with it. So if you take a look at source Dalet, it's Dalet, Hey, and Vav. Three different strategies for koshering very large pots or utensils in general that won't fit into the largest pot you have. The first one in source Dalet, machvas shemitagnin, a pan that you use for frying. And in case you don't know what frying is for some reason, the Shulchan Aruch says, I'll explain it for you, in parentheses. Perisha yotzkin bashemen le'efoso. Meaning that you pour oil into it. They say le'efoso for baking, but they don't necessarily mean that. It could be you bake something in, you know, in oil in it, but it doesn't have to be. So if you have a pan that you're used for frying, muteres behagala. So he says you can do hagala. Now, I'm not sure what that actually frying we don't allow hagala for. So he must mean a different kind of frying. He must not mean the kind of frying we do on a burner. But either way, it's the end of the line that I really wanted to show you. Ve'imhi aruka, if it's too long. So you can't get it into the pot. Hang on 1 second. It's not one thing, it's another. Okay, it should be back now. And I'll go back to sharing that now. Okay. Then he arucha, if the pan's arm is too long, or the pan itself is too long, mesim chetzia, vahofech od, umesim chetzia ha'acher. So what you do is, you take part of this thing that you're kashering, you submerge it in the pot where you're doing the Haggalah, and then you take the other part of it and you submerge that. You do it, in other words, in pieces. That's one answer in the Shulchan Aruch. You do part by part for your Haggalah. That's one approach. However, in Source Hay, he gives you another approach. Source Hay is talking about a mortar. You have this big bowl that you use, like for crushing spices. So he says, Medocha muteres behagala. You can do hagala for this medocha, for this mortar. Ve'imi gedola shenu yacholach nisa biyora. But if it's too big, you can't fit it into your pot. Mesim b'mayim roschin. So he says, what you do is this. Fill the bowl with boiling water. Umachnis besocha even rosachas, and you take a stone that's been heated to the point where it's very, very hot, and you put that in the water. Va'ola harasicha b'chol svasa, and now the water that's in there will overflow. That works as hagala. So he has a second approach, which is fill it with hot water and then cause it to overflow by putting in something very, very hot. You need to make it something very, very hot that you put in there, because otherwise it'll cool off the water and you've defeated your hagala. So that's a second approach. And then the third approach in Source Vav is the approach of our Gemara. If you have a pot that's so big that you can't put it into another pot because it's just too big, so you make a rim for it using clay. So that it will be filled up well, and the water will reach the edge. Fill it with water, marticho, and boil it up. Or he says you take a stone that's very hot, or a torch, and you throw it into it, and that way the water will again overflow. That's the alternative. But he says you use the lip method. He says you should use clay. He didn't say dough. Why didn't he say to use dough? Why did he say to use clay instead?
Dough is a food item that you're going to hold on to set of problems.
The Gemara seemed to be okay with a food item. Think about it.
It'll disintegrate.
No. Where in Shulchan Aruch is this halakha found? Heading for Hilchos Pesach, that's right. The laws of kashering in Shulchan Aruch, it's very interesting. If you open up Yoredeya and you look for laws of kashering, you find one line which says, look at the laws of Pesach. I already told you how to kasher everything there. So you have to go over to the laws of Pesach. If you're doing the laws of Pesach, he's not going to tell you to put dough around the rim when you're kashering it. That would defeat the purpose. So that, yes.
Can I ask a question about the hot stone?
Yes.
What's the practical difference if I just continue to pour more hot water into the pot so that it overflows? Why do I need a stone?
So in other words, why don't I just add... So I think the answer is that the water that you're using has to have been heated inside that pot. I don't think it's sufficient for you to just pour water in from outside, even though the language in one of the cases sounded like you're pouring it in from outside, I think that will be problematic. Because if you're pouring in water from the outside, you always have to be concerned for cooling. That's the Eroi problem.
Isn't that how we pressure our sinks on Pesach? We fill it up one of the ways anyways.
Yeah.
Fill it up from outside with hot water, put in a rock.
Yeah, but there's a reason. Because your sink was never on the stove. In other words, that's all your sink was ever exposed to, was hot water being poured into it. You, the pot is a different story altogether. Yes, Clive?
I have a question. It appears from the fact that you take this pot and you boil it so that the water is going running over the outside of the whole pot, same as with the mortar, where it also will overflow because you're putting the stone in. So the outside of the pot is going to all get washed with this hot water. Surely putting a rim around it is creating a chitza for that. It's, nothing's going to go underneath the...
Right. So
underneath the clay.
Right, and that goes back to Maury's point from before. I think that the answer has to be that in the days of the Gemara, they're not normally overflowing the pot when they cook. And therefore they're not concerned for that. In other words, you're asking, shouldn't you want it to overflow and wash down the sides? But I don't think in the Gemara that they're thinking along those lines. Because you're right, then the strategy would be counterproductive. Unless you wanted to say that the lip you're making is at the bottom of it to keep the fire from going out, but that's not the language of the Gemara at all. I don't think that's true. Yeah, I don't think that that's correct. I hear the question, but yeah, Jared.
Are we particularly concerned about the outside of the pot from a kosher perspective at all?
Yes, because absorption is said to travel through the entire thing, to percolate through the whole thing, or really permeate the whole thing. So yes, it would be a concern, even though it was absorbed in the outside of the pipe. Good question, but I think that's the answer. Okay.
If that's the case, then if you have to cut to the outside of the pipe, how do you achieve that? Is that by just sparks of water going all around onto it? Or?
So you may have just given me the answer to the question. The way you kosher the outside of the pot is the same way you kosher the inside of the pot. Which is to say, when you boil up water inside, you're drawing all the stuff out of the walls, including that which was absorbed on the outside. That's the way it works. In other words, the same way that, as Jared pointed out, right, I'm worried about the impact of stuff that was absorbed in the outside because it might wash through and then emerge in the stuff that's inside. So too, when I do Haggalah inside, I am drawing whatever was absorbed in the outside.
See, the thing that I'm bothered by is that normally you put a little pot into a bigger pot that's boiling water, so it's concussing every surface area of the pot, both in the outside and the inside. Whereas when you have a huge pot and you're just putting boiling water in it, then I'm having trouble understanding how you're going to kosher the whole outside of that pot, even like the bottom.
Right. So again, what we're saying here is that the outside doesn't get. I mean, despite our question for ourselves about the outsides of pots in their day, they didn't overflow the lip. Let me come back and state this, I think, as clearly as I can here. They were not overflowing their pots. That's very clear from the fact that they're concerned about splashing from inside, getting on the top, and they don't talk at all about it washing over. The lip method is meant to enable you to have water overflow in order to kosher the lip, but they're not concerned at all about koshering the sides below it. They're not concerned at all about it. That seems not to have been a consideration. I think that's actually fairly straightforward. That they're not doing that.
On the other hand, though, if you use the hot rock method,
yeah,
there I imagine that if they have boiling water that's near the top, that when you put the hot rock in, it will cause all the water to overflow, and pretty much all the outside will get in contact with the hot water, and that would be more effective.
Right, but that's not the Gemara's solution. The Shulchan Aruch is giving you that solution, but that's not the Gemara's solution. It's a separate halacha.
It seems to make more sense to me.
If you live in a world in which you overflow things in the first place. But
you're saying that we don't have to worry about the outside of the pot?
I'm saying the Gemara doesn't, yeah.
Yeah, because generally, even when the idol worshippers are cook trace type of foods in the pot, it didn't touch the outside?
That's what it seems like, no?
Yeah.
That is what this seems like. As strange as it does sound, and I'm opening the Shulchan Aruch on here now just to take a second look at it. But that really is that's the assumption. They were not.
Why is that the solution only for large pots? And you can do that for small pots too. You can boil hot water in it.
I imagine it's just easier to do it by immersing it in a large pot. You know,
for sure it's easier.
Yeah, I don't know. I could take a look at it before next week and see if I get better insight. But that's what I'm seeing right now. All right, it's already 8:43. What the Gemara is going to do next, and we'll continue with it next time, God willing, is talk about koshering knives. And I remember for years hearing about how you kosher knives by planting them. Is that familiar? So we are going to find out where koshering kitchen equipment by planting it comes from. That'll be part of our discussion, I guess, God willing, next week. But I thank you for the extended discussion about the lip, because that ensured that we would not finish during the 9 days. So I very much appreciate the boost on that. God willing, we pick up then next Sunday evening. Wish everybody a good week and.